What is this life if full of care? We have no time to stand and stare. Occasionally one comes across someone who says they don't like the countryside, that they hate nature, that they much prefer to spend their time in the city, sitting in busy cafes, being in the thick of life. I agree that there is sometimes a certain excitement about being caught up in the throng of people and activity, feeling part of all that energy. I can get a sense of this at Camden Lock, for example, on a summer's day, when I get swept up into the crowd, my senses full of the bright colours of the market stalls, the smells of cooking, the noise of voices and music, the feel of people jostling against me. But for me, the best thing about it is knowing that walking a little further along the canal towpath in either direction will take me away from the crowds and into a more tranquil environment. Some years ago, my partner and I got to know an American couple who came to Britain every Christmas and rented a house in Dartmouth where we were living. They told us they had been to the Scilly Isles. It was a very silly thing to do, the man said. Why, I asked. Well, he said, there was nothing there, nothing to do. I've been to the Scilly Isles and spent a lot of my solitary holiday there going out on small boats, bird watching, seal watching, visiting all the other islands. I remember the hundreds of puffins going in out of their burrows in the steep cliff edge of one of the uninhabited islands. It had been a glorious holiday. But for my American friend, there'd been nothing there, nothing to do. After we moved to Cornwall to a more rural location, this couple wanted to come and stay with us. No, I said, you'd hate it here, you're not coming. And that was more or less the end of the friendship. I grew up in a little hamlet a mile or so outside a small town. We walked another mile to the next village to go to school. We were surrounded by fields. The fields were our playground. My earliest memories are of running out of the house with my sisters, down to the end of our long garden, out through a gap into the lane and then into the first field. In the summer, the grass was cut for hay. The hay lay around on the ground, drying in the sun, and we played in it, making houses. Then the men came and raked it all up into a big hayrick. We would sit with our backs against the rick, soaking up the sun. I was 6 when we moved into the town, but even then it was no more than 10 minutes' walk to be out into the countryside. My father and I used to go out in the early evenings down a country lane to gather armfuls of groundsel to feed our rabbits. At weekends, we children walked along the canal to the next town or went off on long bicycle rides exploring the countryside. I collected wild flowers and carefully pressed them before sticking them into an album, looking up the names to learn them. It was an idyllic rural childhood. But though I so loved the countryside, I was always longing to be for the time to come when I could move to London. London was the centre of the universe as far as I was concerned, and the most exciting place one could possibly be. Actually, London in the 1950s and early 60s wasn't very exciting at all, and certainly no young person today would rate it. Public transport stopped around 10 o'clock. There was nothing much open on Sundays, certainly not any shops. There was very little immigration, diversity or cultural mix, and the sexual revolution hadn't yet begun. Nevertheless, I longed to move to London. I've spent this time talking about my childhood a bit because I think that kind of uncluttered, unhurried, simple life had the benefits of bringing a quality of awareness quite naturally to us children. We lived quite close to nature. We were very familiar with the changing seasons, the cycle of growth in the trees and hedgerows, the different wild plants that flowered at different seasons, the cycle of bird life and patterns of migration. It was all just part of what everyone knew, because you saw it all happening before your eyes. Most children could identify several wild flowers and knew which habitats to look for them in. We had no television, nor did anyone else. We made our own entertainment, and unless it was very wet or cold, we were always out of doors. But life in the city can be very different. And I doubt if many children in this country today grow up close to nature in the way we did in the 1940s and 50s. Most people walk around looking at the electronic gadget they're clutching. They are very unlikely to notice anything much going on around them. You can sit on a crowded bus and hear 20 different languages being spoken, but not one of the people is talking to someone who is actually on the bus. Life can all seem a bit surreal, and yet this is what has become the ordinary. If you walk along your street, pausing to look at what people have growing in their gardens, you might be thought rather peculiar, except, of course, no one even notices you. How many trees do you pass on your way to the station or your bus stop? Have you ever noticed? Are they in the pavement or growing in people's gardens? What kind of trees are they? Do you know when they come into leaf and what colour changes take place when the leaves usually fall? And if you don't know, why don't you? How many times have you walked along that particular stretch of road? How can it be possible to keep walking along the same route without ever really noticing what you are passing? When I teach meditation, I sometimes do a little exercise in which I ask people to visualise their own front door. I ask them what colour it is, what material the door is made of, what sort of letterbox it's got, and where the letterbox is located. Where is the keyhole? What sort of keyhole is it? Is there any beading on the door? And so on and so on. There are lots of details about your own front door which can be brought to mind. But amazingly, many people can hardly even bring the most basic facts about their own front door to mind. Because although they've been in and out through it hundreds of times, they've never actually noticed it. And this is how we go through life. At the start of the talk, I quoted the first two lines of a poem by W.H. Davies. He was a 19th century poet who had a very keen awareness of nature. I was introduced to W.H. Davies in school, and he rather fascinated me. He grew up, he was born at the in the latter part of the 19th century, and grew up in South Wales. And when he was a young man, he was working locally and still living with his family. One evening, he put on his coat and walked out of the door as if he was going down the road to the pub. But in fact, he went off to America. And he spent several years bumming around America and Canada, riding long distances on the trains without paying because he'd clamber onto the roofs or hang on to the undercarriage. And then he, after several years of doing that, he returned, went back to the place where he'd come from, knocked on the door of his parents' house, and his mother opened the door and said, "Oh, hello, it's you." Just as if he had, in fact, only been down the road to the pub. He writes about us at that part of his life in his wonderful autobiography of a super tramp. The poem is called Leisure, and I'm going to read the whole of it. So written in the early 20th century. What is this life if full of care? We have no time to stand and stare. No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep and cows. No time to see when woods we pass where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see in broad daylight streams full of stars like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance and watch her feet, how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich the smile her eyes began. A poor life this, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare. Well, we think we haven't got time to stand around looking at things. We're all much too busy. After all, we have to get on with going to work and doing all the things we need to do. Isn't it rather curious that in modern times, when we have so many labour-saving devices doing things for us which previously were quite time-consuming, that we have less and less time to actually spend noticing what we are doing? We rush around from one thing to the next, juggling and multitasking, and are quite sure that we are far too busy to spend any time being aware. Have you ever tried slowing down and noticing what is going on around you? Do you find you actually have less time? In a way, this is what we do when we're on retreat. We slow down, move around in a mindful manner, and try to become more generally aware of everything, both internally and externally. The days can seem very long, even though we actually go to bed at about 9 o'clock. The retreat seems to last much longer than an equivalent amount of time when we are not on retreat. The daily retreat program has quite a lot in it, yet everything is done in an unhurried, mindful way. We find we still have time to go on longish walks, have in-depth conversations, write a poem, or even read the novel we took with us. Yet in everyday life, there never seems to be time for any of those things. Even though we are spending as many hours in the shrine room each day as we normally spend at work. So how is it that there seem to be more hours in the day when we are on retreat than in our usual life? Contrary to our view that we haven't got time for awareness, when we actually make a conscious effort to be more aware, we find that we seem to have more time. It seems as if time slows down. This is because we are living in the present moment, moving along with time as it unfolds, instead of dashing off in several different directions, backwards and forwards, trying to do numerous things at once, while getting mentally caught up in either the past or the future, but never paying full attention to what we are actually doing. We start things, get distracted, start something else, forget what we set out to do, only remember when we are up against a deadline, then find ourselves fighting against time, lacking the supportive conditions we could have had if we'd been a bit more aware of what we're doing. And this is the way we live a lot of our lives. It's quite exhausting even talking about it. We spend a lot of our mental energy on things we can do nothing about. Endlessly going over something in the past, or worrying ourselves silly about something that hasn't yet happened. And we spend so little of our mental energy paying attention to what is actually going on around us. Now, you might think that someone like me, who grew up in the way I described, someone with a love of nature, someone who goes on long solitary walks, someone who doesn't have to go to work, and has lots of leisure time, well, that someone like me would have a very well-developed practice of awareness. But actually, that is not the case. I can be as unaware as the next person. I can spend hours while walking in the countryside, completely caught up in mental proliferation. and hardly notice anything around me. I walk down the street and might as well have my eyes closed for all I notice. I look out of the bus window and don't see what is going by. Only when a building gets demolished do I realise I never noticed what was there before. I'm often amazed at how unaware I am. Every morning as I get my breakfast, I have to remind myself to do it mindfully. And sometimes I simply forget. But when I get my breakfast fully aware of what I'm doing, it becomes a pleasurable thing to do, instead of being another task to be got through. I then don't find I've put two tea bags into the pot instead of one, or none at all, which sometimes happens. I don't knock my head on the cupboard door because I've moved with it before closing it. I don't spill the muesli all over the worktop, and I don't sit down to eat my breakfast and then find I haven't got my pills. I get my breakfast together in a slow, methodical manner and take pleasure in anticipating the eating of it. And I get my breakfast after I have fed my cat. I don't try to do the two things at the same time. My cat finds her food is much nicer if I crouch down on the floor beside her while she eats. And it's nicest of all if I hold the saucer for her. I find myself saying, "Oh, Mimi, I haven't got time for this." That's hardly ever true. I do have time. And in fact, just being with her and watching her eat is very pleasurable. I look at the colours in her beautiful coat. I notice the way her whiskers move as she eats. I enjoy watching her enjoying her food. I've lived back in the city for over 15 years, but I've only been able to live in the hustle and bustle of city life by combining it with a lot of time spent in nature and a lot of time spent in solitude. Before moving back to London, I was living in Cornwall on the Atlantic coast, a couple of miles north of Land's End. I spent my working day mostly in solitude, growing plants for my partner to sell in our garden shop in Penzance. I spent hours sitting in the potting shed or working in the polytunnels in the garden, propagating plants, growing things on, watching new growth. I was surrounded by insects and birds and the gentle gurgling sounds of water running into the pond. I would stop in my work and sit beside the pond, just looking. It was teeming with life. If I sat for long enough and really looked, I saw new life coming into being. Nymphs crawling up the reeds from the water where they'd lived for 2 or 3 years, then metamorphosing into a beautiful dragonfly, gradually stretching its wings and drying off in the sun before taking off in flight for its short adult life. When I sat very still, butterflies, dragonflies, damselflies and bees would land on my arms and hands, and I could observe them closely for the few moments they rested there. The dazzling iridescent colours of the dragonflies, the velvetiness of the butterfly's wings, and the lovely tickle of a bee with its sacks full of pollen walking up my arm. In the afternoon, I would walk down to the coast and look at the sea. Sometimes I just sat on the rocks watching the waves crashing against them, hurling up great spumes of white foam. And sometimes I would walk along the coast to Whitsun Bay, a huge, unspoilt sandy beach, and I'd sit and let the sand trickle through my fingers while watching the waves ebb and flow. Half the cottages in the valley were holiday lets, and the same people came from the cities year after year. My partner was an artist and very good at looking at things. He used to take the holiday children, along with the children from the neighbouring farm, out on nature walks. He took pencils and sketchbooks, and after a good walk during which he pointed out all sorts of things, birds, insects, flowers, he would get the children to sit somewhere quietly and just look at something and draw it. These children who'd arrived from the city looking pasty and dull, and whose recreation seemed to consist mostly of watching videos, would return from these walks rosy-cheeked, full of energy, bubbling over with enthusiasm for what they'd seen, eager to show their drawings and talk about them. Some of these children, now grown up, have kept in touch and talk about how inspired they were by these walks. Some of them regularly come back to Cornwall on holiday, bringing their own children with them. But these days, children who live in cities have so much more in the way of electronic things and spend hours in front of computers. When I compare their childhoods with mine, I see theirs as impoverished, even though they have so much more in the way of material goods. Recently, I spent a day with my nephew and his children, aged 5 and 7. We went to the London Wetlands Centre and spent some of the time there pond dipping. This is an activity set up to educate children. There are some small raised ponds, each surrounded by a low, wide wall on which are set trays of water. The children are given little nets and they reach over into the pond and then they empty the nets into the trays of water and look to see what they've caught. And there's a colour chart to compare what things they've caught with, and also several knowledgeable young helpers. I was delighted to see how much the children enjoyed this activity and how interested they were in identifying what they had scooped up. And looking around at all the other young children, so evidently enjoying looking and learning about pond life, it gave me a huge sense of relief and hope. A lot of people love nature. They love to settle down in a comfortable armchair with a cup of tea and watch a good nature programme on the television. In fact, there are dozens of excellent nature programmes we can watch. As David Attenborough roams the world, we can enjoy seeing wildlife we would never see in our own experience. We can see inside the nests of birds and watch the hatching and development of the young chicks through programmes like Springwatch. But if we never stir out of our armchairs, how much can we say that we are really being aware of nature? More and more knowledgeable, maybe. But does this TV watching actually help us to become more aware? Are we more likely to notice the birds in the local park because we've watched a programme about birds on television? What tends to happen is that we become much more concerned with knowing about the birds than in actually seeing them. This is the difference between bird watchers and twitchers. Twitchers are not interested in birds. They are only interested in ticking things off lists. It's the adult version of number plate spotting, which small boys used to do. And because it's something which requires a lot of expensive gear, it's a very attractive hobby to many people. I remember one day walking along the lane where I lived in Cornwall. A car raced down into the valley, screeched to a stop, and 4 men jumped out. "Look, look, there it is," they called. Out came the binoculars and the telescopes. They were looking at a hawk hovering in the sky. "What is it?" I asked them. "Goshawk," they said. Then, "Oh no, it isn't, it's just a kestrel." And they jumped back into the car and roared off back out of the valley in a cloud of dust. The bird was still there, and it was still the same bird. But these men had only been interested in it as long as they thought it was something they could tick off their list. And it wasn't, it was too ordinary. So they had no further interest in it. If we are trying to develop an awareness of nature, of what is around us, we have to be interested in what is actually there. Maybe it does seem all rather ordinary, as if it's nothing we haven't seen before. But if we think that, it's a sure indication that we are not actually looking properly. Each moment is unique, never to be repeated. If we allow ourselves to stand still, to really experience what is there, we won't fail to marvel at the miracle of life and be moved by its beauty. But what so often happens is that we see something beautiful and immediately want to hold on to it. We happen to have a camera in our hand. Well, it's a minority of people who don't, these days, don't walk around clutching a smartphone. And so we instantly photograph the tree, the flower, the bird, or whatever it is that's caught our attention. Now we have captured the moment, we have it to keep, and we feel satisfied. But what has actually happened? We now have a digitalized, two-dimensional, second-hand version of something we saw and thought was beautiful. And we may, though we probably won't, at some point get round to looking at it. We took the photo and then moved our attention onto something else. We didn't actually look at what it was we saw. We weren't really interested in it being with our experience, only in appropriating it, having it to keep. I know myself how strong the temptation is to want to capture what I see on camera. It can become almost an obsession. If I have my camera with me, I want to photograph every lovely thing I see. And I know that in the very act of photographing, I am no longer having the experience of seeing it. And when I don't have my camera, I find myself feeling I've missed an opportunity to get a good photo. If we really want to be aware of nature, I think we have to forget about the camera. Well, squeaky thing doesn't take being lent on. It's not possible to capture an experience. It is only possible to have a memento of it. And so often we end up with a memento of an experience we didn't actually have. In Vision and Transformation, Banti tells the story of the Japanese novice who wanted to paint bamboos. His teacher tells him that before he can paint bamboos, he needs to look at bamboos. Not just a cursory glance, not just looking for a few minutes, but actually spend years looking at bamboos before he can begin to paint them. Well, I don't suppose many artists are prepared to spend years looking at before they lift a paintbrush. But I've often heard artists say that the reason they are able to draw such lifelike portraits of people and animals is because they really look at their subject properly and keep looking all the time they're drawing. The ability to look closely and see what is there is something which doesn't seem to come very naturally to many of us and is something we need to develop. As a child, I used to be told I was observant. I noticed things. But in such a simple way of life, there wasn't all that much to notice. I think I am rather selectively observant. I notice some things, but not others. I often think I would make a very bad police witness. I would find it hard to describe someone I'd only seen briefly. In fact, would probably be able to say very little about them. My awareness is limited. It narrows down around aspects of my experience which interest me and cuts me off from everything else. I'm often aware of this limitation in my awareness. Full awareness with full attention is something I aspire to, but forget all about much of the time. I find it useful to ask myself, what is my mind doing? So often I find it's not in the present moment at all. If I'm thinking about myself, if I'm thinking about something, I ask myself, am I thinking with positivity? If I find my mind is reactive or aversive, then in a way, what hope is there for what I'm about to say or do next? About 8 years ago, I was doing a long solitary retreat in a hut in the New Zealand forest. The temperatures was in the 30, and the hut had windows all the way around, including big glass sliding doors along one side. With all the windows open, it was a glorious place to sit and meditate during the day. But the hut was full of buzzing flies, which drove me mad. great ugly yellow flies which had a very annoying loud buzz. So I would sit on my stool trying to practice the metta bhavana with my mind full of aversion to these flies. I realised I couldn't go on like this. I wasn't going to have the windows closed, and the flies weren't going to go away. So the only option open to me was to do something with my own mind. I decided to get interested in the flies. So instead of seeing them as an annoying distraction to my meditation, I began to look at them as living beings. I let them settle on my arms, and instead of impatiently brushing them off, I really looked at them. I noticed that they weren't ugly at all. In fact, they were really beautiful. They shimmered with different colours. They had the most complex eyes. And the way they cleaned their faces and antennae with their pairs of legs was fascinating. I began to notice the buzz of the flies and learned to identify the age of a fly by the pitch of its buzz and the duration of its flight. I could tell when a fly was coming to the end of its life and watch it settle on the window pane from which it would have dropped down in death. When I meditated, the flies were no longer a distraction. They were just there, in my peripheral awareness. I realised that the flies had bothered me so much because I was listening to the stories my mind was telling me. I don't like flies. They're dirty, irritating creatures. I can't meditate with all that noise going on. But those stories had in my mind had nothing to do with my actual experience. When I brought my mind into awareness of what was actually there, I had quite a different experience, a different response. I tried to bring my mind into the present moment, into my actual experience, into an awareness of what is going on around me. Sometimes it can be helpful to concentrate on one of the senses at a time and allow my awareness to open up to what comes through it. A couple of years ago, on a solitary retreat, I walked a section of the Cornish coast path, and I concentrated on each sense in turn. So as I walked, I looked. I noticed the colours in the sky and how the clouds formed and moved and changed. I saw the sea in constant motion, colours forming and changing. I saw the foliage along the path, the flowers, the insects, birds darting through the undergrowth, wheeling through the sky. Then I listened. Waves crashed against the rocks, gulls screeched, small birds sang, insects buzzed, and long grasses rustled in the breeze. I inhaled the smell of the sea and the lovely fresh smell of recently rain-washed growth. Wild honeysuckle gave off sweet perfume, gorse flowers their coconutty scent, and the unmistakable smell of cow parsley pervaded the air. In my mouth I could taste the tang of salt carried in from the sea and a mingling of coffee and toothpaste. As I walked, my feet felt the ground firm beneath them. My clothes shifted against my body as I moved, and my legs and arms were brushed and tickled by the foliage as I passed. Beads of sweat formed under the brim of my hat and slowly rolled down the sides of my face. I walked in full awareness of the present moment, allowing each sense to really experience what was there. It was beautiful, delightful, and an experience I probably won't forget. I didn't need a camera. I didn't need to try and capture my experience to look at later. I had the experience there and then, and because I was committed to full awareness of what I was experiencing, it both changed and expanded me, and has remained with me as a very fond memory, in a way no photograph could ever do. I'm going to finish with another poem by W.H. Davies. And this is not one you'll ever have found in an anthology, because although it was written in the early, probably about 1916, something like that, it wasn't published. And in fact, it wasn't discovered until earlier this year among some of his papers. And it's called Nature. He lived a hermit for a year. His cottage had no other near. And there his summer days would spend, with only nature for his friend. He listened for no loved one's feet, and yet his lonely life was sweet. The simplest things had then the power to claim his care from hour to hour. A small wild blossom was so fair, it filled him with a miser's care when near his goal that miser stands and laughs with both his lips and hands. Ah, what a joy to sit at night and see the lighted trains in sight. To see those trains like lizards glide through trees upon the dark hillside. Or ere one came in sight, to hear that iron beast as it drew near, when barking hoarsely it would come, faster and faster, out of some far kennel town, or into a tunnel, dash with smoke clouds from its funnel. Or when, upon a misty night, it in the distance with its light passed like a comet in that space where late the hills had held their place.